Support for The Best of Our Knowledge comes from the College of St. Rose in Albany, offering master's and certificate programs for working adults looking to advance or change their careers. Easily accessible to downtown and state offices, the College of St. Rose has served the Capital District since 1920. strose.edu/grad programs for applications.
This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Here it is. We're midway through 2017, and we're still talking about No Child Left Behind. And that was, you know, two presidents ago. Right now in New York State, they're working on replacing that Bush-era initiative to the Obama-era Every Student Succeeds Act.
We've taken the time, I think, to get feedback from professionals across the state in education to help us to craft a plan that is good and supportive.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, New York's Education Commissioner hears from the public. We'll also hear from protesters who want a controversial local school board member kicked out, learn that self-awareness is important to get ahead in the world, and we'll spend an academic minute building a better bus route. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. New York State Education Commissioner Mary Ellen Illia is touring the state, holding public hearings on New York's draft regulations to meet the federal Every Student Succeeds Act, which replaces No Child Left Behind. She recently stopped in the northern New York city of Plattsburgh to hear comments from educators and the public on the proposals. The Best of Our Knowledge's Pat Bradley reports.
In December 2015, President Obama signed ESSA, or the Every Student Succeeds Act. ESSA's requirements include provisions that all schools teach to high academic standards, annual statewide assessments to measure progress toward those standards, advancement of equity in schools and districts, and accountability and action to address low-performing schools. Commissioner Mary Ellen Illia explains that since the law was signed, states have been reviewing its regulations and determining their draft plans.
We have been working for over a year with representatives from organizations and groups and many teachers, parents, and administrators and really practitioners in education to give us their thoughts on what should be included. So what we have is a draft plan. There are still requirements from the federal government that may not please everyone. We have to do those requirements, but we've taken the time, I think, to get feedback from professionals across the state in education to help us to craft a plan that is good and supportive.
Illia adds that the draft plan relies on more than just test scores to assess schools.
That will be a big shift. The way, the approach that you take with the school that may be having a difficulty moving their students towards success is much more productive, much more supportive, and understanding that every school is not the same. Every community is not the same.
Very few individuals spoke at the sparsely attended public hearing held on the SUNY Plattsburgh campus. School librarian Sarah Kelly Johns began the comments.
Digital literacy has become more important in our society. A recent study from the Stanford History Education Groups point out that many students actually are not very good at distinguishing true from false. School librarians teach digital literacy.
Speaker number 4, Lorene Saunders from CVES.
In reading the draft paper, what you're proposing on the measuring, please, let's keep it based in reality. The only other concern I had was more schools offering more advanced courses getting credit. That's wonderful. But is it truly reality-based?
Michelle Bushy.
Good evening. I am an educator with over 23 years' experience in science, and I teach at Saranac Central High School. One of the most important concerns that all of our educators have, all of our school districts have, is that in the upcoming school year, New York State owes public school districts $3.6 billion. We've not fully restored the programs that have been cut over the past decade, so we are concerned that there aren't details in how the funding for some of the requirements within ESSA are going to be made.
Warrensburg Superintendent of Schools John Goralski says he is most interested in the accountability provisions.
The concern for me is the idea of holding schools accountable for student attendance, specifically chronic absenteeism. And while it sounds good that attendance is certainly an indicator of student performance, the schools don't have a lot of clout in forcing kids to come to school.
Plattsburgh was the sixth of 13 public hearings being held across the state. The New York State Department of Education is taking comments on the draft plan through June 16th. Reporting for the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Pat Bradley.
Meanwhile, activists from Western New York looking to get Commissioner Elia's attention recently held a demonstration at the New York State Education Department building in Albany. The group had hoped to confront her with their demand that Carl Paladino be kicked off the Buffalo Board of Education. But Mary Ellen Elia was out of town. The Best of Our Knowledge's Dave Lucas has more.
But the 15 or so demonstrators lacked in numbers, they made up for in vocal spirit.
Racist, sexist, anti-gay, Paladino, go away!
The protesters made the trip from Buffalo to Albany on Wednesday to demand Carl Paladino's removal from their local Board of Education.
We came from Buffalo today to talk to Commissioner Elia about Carl Paladino's removal. Several positions have been filed against him, and so far a hearing has been set, but it's only about one of the petitions, and it's going to be in June here in Albany, and we would really like the commissioner to meet with the people in Buffalo, since they're the ones that are most affected by it.
That's Colleen Christich with Surge Buffalo, showing up for racial justice. Elia denied a previous request to meet with representatives from the group, which has been beating the drum for Paladino's ouster since he made comments regarding President Barack Obama and former First Lady Michelle Obama in an article that appeared in December in Buffalo's alternative weekly newspaper, Art Voice. A frustrated Whitney Crispell of Surge Buffalo says the group has made its presence known at several Buffalo school board meetings.
We've shown up and had demonstrations multiple times. People there are ready to see him go. His antics have not stopped, just so everybody's aware who might be hearing this outside of Buffalo. He has continued to say racist things and take racist actions. He just headlined a white supremacist rally in the city of Buffalo. We really, really need Commissioner Elia to do the right thing and get rid of him.
On its Facebook page, Surge Buffalo notes that this is the first time the group's protests have been acknowledged by the commissioner's office.
Whose side are you on, Elia? Whose side are you on?
Protesters hope to convince the commissioner to hold a hearing in Buffalo, not Albany. Instead, Executive Deputy Commissioner Elizabeth Berlin met with the group, telling protesters Elia was not in town.
I'm not in a position to provide information that I don't have.
And would you convey our questions to the commission?
I will certainly bring back this conversation.
Berlin advised them if they plan to return for the June 22nd hearing, they might look into getting a permit from the city of Albany to stage a protest outside the building on the sidewalk. Elia was speaking at a women's educational empowerment conference at the Embassy Suites in Saratoga Springs. Her office answered a request for comment by email stating, quote, "Because this matter is before the commissioner, she must remain impartial, as a judge would in a court proceeding, and therefore cannot comment in any way." Dennis Vacco, a former New York State Attorney General who is representing Paladino before Elia, dismissed the demonstration.
It's my understanding that some of the protesters were Buffalo teachers, so it's not surprising to us that the Buffalo Teachers Federation would be organizing these protests in a fashion to try to unduly influence the commissioner. We're not going to be cowed by this silliness, these demonstrations. Our defense is not going to change. Quite frankly, the conduct of the Buffalo Teachers Federation, NYSET, plays right into our case because we believe that they have conspired with the majority members of the Board of Education to attack Carl Paladino in a retaliatory fashion for his comments that he made in December, which they obviously disagreed with. And this whole thing is about retaliation against Carl for the exercise of his First Amendment rights.
According to the Buffalo News, the Buffalo Board of Education originally sought Palladino's removal for the comments about the Obamas, then changed course on the advice of its attorney. The board majority's argument now is Palladino violated district policy when he published information about teacher contract negotiations that had been discussed in an exclusive session. Whitney Crispell reminds us the hearing is scheduled for 9 a.m. June 22nd at the State Education Department in Albany.
The commissioner's office is no doubt aware that there are many, many, many people fired up about this and that we plan on having a presence there. There will be an opportunity for the public to come and watch those proceedings, and we will be there.
Officials note that although the hearing is open to the public, space will be limited. Reporting for the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Dave Lucas.
Still to come, to get ahead in life, you need a bit of self-awareness. Well, maybe more than just a bit. That's next on the Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our world is becoming increasingly self-absorbed and increasingly less self-aware. At least that's what Dr. Tasha Urich thinks. Research shows that self-awareness is the foundation for high performance, smart choices, and lasting relationships. Without it, it's impossible to master the skills needed to succeed in school, business, and life. Skills like emotional intelligence and empathy, influence and persuasion, communication and collaboration. Dr. Tasha Urich is an organizational psychologist, researcher, New York Times best-selling author. Her latest book is called Insight: Why We're Not as Self-Aware as We Think and How Seeing Ourselves Clearly Helps Us Succeed at Work and in Life. She spoke about the book with the Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue.
All right, so let's talk first about a definition and just have a baseline, which is how do you define and what exactly is self-awareness?
Great place to start. So it's made up of two types of knowledge about ourselves. The first is what I call internal self-awareness, which is what people normally think of when they hear that term. It's knowing who you are, what you value, what you're passionate about, you know, what do you want to achieve in your life. But at the same time, and equally importantly, we have to have something called external self-awareness, which in a nutshell is knowing how other people see us. And the fascinating part about these two types of self-awareness is they're completely independent. Everybody has a friend, for example, that thinks they're in touch with all of their deepest inner workings. Maybe they spend a lot of money every year on therapy or meditation retreats, but they have absolutely no idea how they're coming across to the people around them. And by the same token, somebody might be so interested in how other people see them that they lose sight of what really matters to them. So self-awareness is a process of balancing those two things and prioritizing those two things.
So if you ask the average person if they feel that they are self-aware, you are here to tell us that most people will respond that yes, they are self-aware, although your research shows otherwise.
My research has found that 95% of people think they're self-aware, but the real percentage is closer to 10 to 15%. And the joke I always make is that means on a good day, 80% of us are lying to ourselves about whether we're lying to ourselves. And, you know, the intention with that isn't to get people down. It's instead to get us questioning and saying, am I really as clear about who I am as I thought I was? And if I wasn't, how would I know?
What does it tell us about those 10 to 15%? What are they doing right? And are they happier than the other 80%?
Unquestionably, they are. I studied highly self-aware people who actually didn't start out that way. And what I found was not a lot of patterns demographically. It didn't matter what age they were, what gender they were, what job they were in. But the commonality were two things. Number one was value placed on knowing themselves, a very profound kind of personal value. And then number two was a daily commitment to increasing that awareness, whether it was through personal reflection, getting feedback from other people, or even just questioning those assumptions we have about ourselves. And so that's the first place to start, I think, for most of us, is to entertain that notion that we might not be as self-aware as we think. That leads to a greater sense of self-acceptance.
So in the book, these people you refer to as self-awareness unicorns. How did that phrase come about?
One of my research assistants actually said it as a joke really early on, and we started to laugh about it, and then we said, actually, this is a really good term because, you know, unicorns, everyone thinks they're special, they're
right.
Mythical, no one believes they exist, just like these people who started off unself-aware and really came to have a deep and profound knowledge of themselves.
One of the things that you write about in the book, and I think it's fascinating, is social media and what it does to us, and the fact that you argue makes us much more narcissistic and much less self-aware as a culture, because we almost inoculate ourselves from anything that is outside our bubble.
That's it. And we surround ourselves with people who share our beliefs and who will like the pictures that we post of our breakfast as though that is a greater sense of importance in all of our lives. And the research on this is very clear. It shows that there is a causal link between how much we use social media and how self-absorbed we are. And when you have that sense of self-absorption, you're not seeing yourself clearly. The other interesting thing, though, was that our unicorns, and I was shocked to find this, actually used social media more than the average person. And I was kind of scratching my head until I discovered how they use it is very different as well from the average person. So basically, instead of using social media as a me megaphone, they use it as a way to enrich other people's lives, you know, to post a beautiful picture they took or to recommend a book that they love or an article that they found valuable. It's really not necessarily about how much time we spend, but how we're using that time that can trip us up or help us.
The other thing that was interesting, I thought, in your research is that it's really across the board. You know, people will say, oh, that's the millennial thing, but it's really, this is something that cradle to grave narcissism.
Yes, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but I also feel like as the oldest millennial, I have to defend my generation. Yes, it's true that, you know, empirically, younger people tend to be more self-absorbed no matter what generation they're in. But I've found these patterns, and so have others, regardless of age. So I think it's one of those very convenient delusions we have that, oh, it's just the millennials, and therefore it's not my issue to deal with. But I think we'd all do well to really question that assumption.
So how do we find a balance in that of, as you say, that you're the unicorns, they use social media more. So what can we learn from what they do and from their habits to become more self-aware? And not only that, but as I indicated in an earlier question, be more aware of our society around us.
Right. I think, you know, in addition to what I mentioned earlier about focusing on others and their posts and not themselves, it's also important to really think about the version of you that you're portraying on social media. There's a lot of writing that's come out recently that we sort of put forward this idealized version of ourselves. And the weird thing about that is when we do that and we compare the way our life really is to that idealized version, it actually makes us more depressed, less confident. And so it's not that I'm recommending that, you know, self-aware people post like all of the deepest, darkest, horrible secrets that they have, but rather it's to try to not post that idealized version of yourself and to be a little bit more honest. You know, to be honest with others, you have to start by being honest with yourself. So I think that's another tip I would give people, is to avoid the trappings of those idealized versions that we feel like we have to portray.
So you're walking down 6th Avenue, and you see Sting, and you say, oh, hi, Sting. Is it okay if I take a picture? And you take a picture with Sting. Okay, so first of all, you got to meet Sting. Second of all, it would be neat to share that with people on your Facebook page, maybe. Then you notice that you have a small little ice cream stain on your white shirt. So you go in and you take just a little tool that removes that stain from the picture, and then you notice that there's a little blotch in your face. So you move that, and then there's that line under your eye and above your eyebrow, and you remove that, and then you put it online. But that's normal, isn't it?
Well, who am I to say what's normal? The psychologist. One of the things I've learned is what we think is normal is not, and vice versa. But
that we always want to, I mean, I understand your point, but we are always trying to present, you know, when people come over to the house, we try to clean up the house because we don't want them to think that we live in that squalor every day.
I think there's a difference between being sort of yourself on your best behavior or the best version of yourself and stretching that past what is reasonably true.
Okay.
So, you know, if you're photoshopping Sting in or that rapper Bow Wow who
right.
posted a picture of his private plane and somebody caught him flying commercial on that same day, those are the kinds of things
okay.
that we're sort of pressured to live this life that maybe we're not actually living. That's where I think we get into trouble.
When you look at the end game here, for those of us who have a lot to learn when it comes to self-awareness, for the unicorns, as you saw them through this journey, how long is this process? I mean, I know it's different for everyone, but how aware are you of how you're progressing in your own self-awareness?
It's a great question. I was gratified to learn that even the most self-aware people are never satisfied and never feel like they're done. Does that mean that we have to wake up every morning and put this pressure on ourselves? Definitely not. If anything, what the unicorns taught me was there are relatively small habits we can adopt on a daily basis that help us improve our self-knowledge. And there's something freeing to me about the idea that it's a lifelong process and we're kind of never done. We don't have to wait for this bolt of insight or to have this, you know, huge life-changing moment. We have those incremental insights on a daily basis, and if we add those up over the course of a year or a decade or a lifetime, that's where we can make those really dramatic improvements.
Again, the name of Dr. Tasha Urich's new book is Insight, Why We're Not as Self-Aware as We Think and How Seeing Ourselves Clearly Helps Us Succeed at Work and in Life. She spoke with the best of our knowledge's Joe Donahue. Are the school buses in your town the best that they can be? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
We all hate waiting behind a school bus on the way to work. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Ali Haqqani, professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Maryland, determines if school bus routes could be made more efficient.
Transporting school children is a complex and expensive operation. Generally, there are a number of buses that serve the schools in the morning and in the afternoon. In the afternoon, for example, each bus picks up students from the school and goes through a number of stops at which it drops off students until it is empty. This is called a trip. After a trip is completed, the bus can go either to another school to do another trip, or it can go back to its depot. When trips from different schools are linked, we have a bus route. We have been working with Howard County Public School System over the past year to analyze the impact of changing their high school start times on their transportation operations. In this process, we developed three interrelated models. One of these models basically links the trips for different schools together in a manner that minimizes the total number of buses that are needed for these trips. We applied this model in Howard County and showed that the county can save between 5% to 7% in the number of buses they need for their transportation operations. The second model deals with designing the trips. Given the location of schools, the location of bus stops, and the number of students at each stop, this model designs bus trips by minimizing the number of trips for the schools and maximizing how they can be linked together. The third model looks at the school start times and assigns bell time within a pre-specified time window by minimizing the total number of buses needed to provide the transportation services for all of the schools. These models can be readily applied in any other school district across the nation. With many municipalities struggling with tight budgets, these models can be very helpful in increasing the efficiency without degrading service.
That was Ali Haghani. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.